Hey there, listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. Audible.com is offering Beyond the Uniform listeners one free audiobook. You can see this offer, as well as a list of every book guests have recommended on the show, at beyondtheuniform.io/books. That's beyondtheuniform.io/books. Thanks and enjoy the show. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 53 with Chris Pestel.
From the process of, you know, going through West Point and then being an officer and then deciding where you're going to go next, you know, one of the things that's first told you is that once you do that, you can do whatever you want. You know, you basically can write your path. And I think I took that to heart. If I can do whatever I want, this is what I want to do. It was a thing where I picked up a camera, I started photographing a few things and really, really enjoyed it. It was very intuitive and I liked that. It was the closest thing I had found to playing sports, to where it was develop the muscle memory and then just let instinctive ability kind of take over, and you kind of get lost in the flow of what's going on. And I really, really wanted to keep doing that. If I got to choose what I could do, that's what I wanted to do. And so that's how I found myself in that situation, and then just dove neck deep in it and tried to figure it out.
This is my 53rd episode with Beyond the Uniform, and I have to admit, it's probably my favorite interview to date. Chris is an incredible human being, and I found his story very inspiring. If that's not enough reason to listen, here are my top four reasons to listen to today's show. Number one, courage. Chris left the Army to become a photographer. I found it difficult to dive into entrepreneurship, and that was from business school in the Bay Area, where startups are very normal. Chris, on the other hand, took a leap of faith to follow his passion. Initially, he had to tell people to ignore his background and education in order to consider him for jobs for which he seemed overqualified. And it worked. He owns his own company and has worked with both Playboy and ESPN. 2. Do what you know. There was no roadmap for Chris. He talks about how he took baby steps to start with what he knew and then worked tirelessly to fill in the gaps. 3. Craft. Chris is a case study in honing one's craft. He talks about it in a way that could benefit a listener in any industry, how he immersed himself, surrounded himself with the community, researched in the library, and more. Number 4, don't panic. Chris went from earning $75,000 a year in the Army to $19,000 a year initially. He talks about making sacrifices to get to where you want to go and the difference between patience and panic. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other great episodes and resources, including show notes to links to all the things we talk about in this episode. So let's dive in to my interview with Chris Pestel. Joining me today outside of Chicago is Chris Pestel. Chris, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you for having me.
So, quick bio for listeners. Chris is the founder of Pestel Photography. He's worked as a freelance photographer for ESPN for nearly 9 years now. He started out at West Point, after which he served as an Army officer for 5 years. After his transition, he started out as a photographer at Carolina Sports before moving on to Playboy Enterprises as a junior designer and photo editor. He's also served as the director of public relations for his high school alma mater, Montini Catholic. Chris has run his company, Pestel Photography, for over 9 years, making him on the verge of the 4% of entrepreneurs who keep their company running for 10 years. So first thing I always like to ask is if you could take us back to when you knew you were going to leave the Army and how you approached that decision.
It was probably about 6 months out in the fall, about 2007. Was when I really first picked up a camera with the intention of doing that as a career. It was a matter of just picking up a camera and then kind of not looking back. I had put my paperwork in about a year out. I knew I was getting out. I was for the majority of the time that I was in, I was a single father. And so I knew pretty quickly that it was me about a 5 year plan to stay in the Army and then move on to something else. Like I said, it was within that 6 months was really the window with which I decided what my path was going to be. And, you know, here we are, you know, eight plus years later, and, you know, I'm still shooting. So,
and that was one of the things I was really excited to learn is, so you said about a year before you got out was when you picked up the camera with the thought of doing it professionally. Had you been doing photography your whole life, or when did you first get into photography?
That's been an interesting, kind of rediscovery for me. The photography aspect of it, you know, was kind of here and there, but never really a focal point at any point in time. In about 2003, I picked up a Polaroid camera and used that kind of extensively for the last year and a half of West Point. And I actually took a creative writing class. I was an art, philosophy, and literature major at West Point. And we had a creative writing class. And in that, I talked quite a bit about the desire to capture imagery in sort of a kind of storytelling, from a storytelling perspective. And so, but I didn't realize that until maybe about 2 years ago when I was going back through old papers. And so it's been this process of kind of connecting the dots to some past points in my life to where this desire to do this was springing up, but not quite taking hold yet. Mm. And so, the photography aspect just it was a new thing, basically.
Mm. I was just really excited. So Annie Taft, who's also been on the show, connected us, and I was just very excited because it's such a different career path that you've chosen. And I'm wondering, was that difficult when you made that decision? Were you just immediately all in, or was there some inner doubt, or were people trying to like talk you out of this, or what was that decision process like when you did say, "Hey, I'm going to actually give this a go"?
Yeah, one of the things that gets fed to you a lot, from the process of, you know, going through West Point and then being an officer and then deciding where you're going to go next, you know, one of the things that's first told you is that once you do that, you can do whatever you want. You know, you basically can write your path. And I think I took that to heart, where it was like, you know, if I can do whatever I want, this is what I want to do. It was a thing where I picked up a camera, I started photographing a few things. I was working as a door guy at a small music venue in South Carolina. And once the initial rush of the door kind of subsided, I would take the camera and start photographing the acts, the musicians, and really, really enjoyed it. And it was this thing that it was very intuitive. And I liked that. It was the closest thing I had found to playing sports, to where it was develop the muscle memory and then just let that instinctive ability kind of take over, and you kind of get lost in the flow of what's going on. And I really, really wanted to keep doing that. If I got to choose what I could do, that's what I wanted to do. And so that's how I found myself in that situation. And then, you know, just dove, you know, neck deep in it and tried to figure it out.
That's so awesome. When you separated then, I know you went on to work at Carolina Sports. How did you navigate? Like, take me from when you got out of the military till you started at Carolina Sports. How did you find that?
Okay, so that was, like I said, I had about that 6 month window where I was like, okay, what do I do? Where do I, you know, go? Who do I talk to? And you know, I had come across this photography thing, and I had been an athlete my entire life. And so, you know, the advice that writers always get is you write what you know. And so I just kind of transposed that over to photography. And I said, well, I'm going to shoot what I know. And so it wasn't a real desired outcome to be shooting like sports team or the team portrait stuff, but I knew it was an arena that I was comfortable in. Mm-hmm. And so I just went and did a little bit of research, found a company that basically had a stranglehold on all of the athletics throughout the state of South Carolina, and went on a shoot with the owner of the company. He was going up to Clemson, and he was a pilot too. And so we jumped in his plane from the little regional airport, flew up to Clemson, photographed the team. I was like, I'm in. Like, when can I start? And he goes, when are you done with the Army? I'm like, done on April 15th. He's like, okay, you can start on April 16th. And I was like, okay. So it was, I had about 45 days of terminal leave saved up. And I went to work. I signed out at about 2 o'clock on a Monday and I went to work on a Tuesday. And I made the transition from making, I don't know, I was probably making close to 70,000-75,000 as a captain with BAH to making $19,000 and didn't care.
There's so much I love about what you said, but so one of the things that jumps out at me as you're talking is so many people that I've interviewed have gone on much more traditional paths of business and things like that. And even for them, it's such a coming from the military, it's such a jumping off point of like, what do I do and who do I talk to and who are my role models? And it seems like you made a jump even further by comparison, where there's not a lot of role models and a lot of guidance. And so I really like what you were saying about do what you know. Like you took that baby step in the direction of what was familiar enough to find your own way. And I just admired the willingness to jump off to take that pay cut to have alignment of something you were just really passionate about. I think that's very, very rare that people have the courage to do that. So next thing I wanted to ask about, so you're at Carolina Sports. You've taken this pay cut, but you're just completely passionate about this. What did your day-to-day life look like? What does it look like to be a photographer at a sports team like that?
You'd show up somewhere in the morning time, depending on what the shoot that day required, and you'd hop in one of the company vehicles. You'd drive to some corner of South Carolina, usually after school, because that's when the majority of the shoots would take place. You'd be there from about 3:30 to about 5, maybe shooting anywhere from one team to, 6 or 7 teams in a day. And, hop back in the car, head back to the office, maybe download the images, right then and there, or you do it the next morning before you go out to your next shoot and kind of repeat the process. And so it was monotonous in to a certain degree, but it was very different, being presented with a lot of different challenges on a daily basis, from who you're coordinating with the school. Is it a coach? Is it an athletic director? Is the athletic director attuned with the coach? So there's a lot of, potential pitfalls there. And then on top of that, then you don't know what, you're shooting inside or you're shooting outside. Is the gym well lit? Is the gym poorly lit? Is there a big mural that they want to have in the background? Is there a big parking lot you want to avoid? And it's the process of kind of problem solving on that daily basis, which is, even though it was a monotonous sort of process, there was enough within that to kind of keep it. It was a really good stepping stone for somebody who had never done it before, because you learned how to problem solve quickly in the presence of all these other people. Sometimes you can get into a studio situation where it's just you and a still life, or you and a model or a subject or whatever, and you can kind of slowly go through it. But when you've got a line of 75 kids that are all high schoolers, all talking, and then you got a coach that doesn't want practice to be interfered with, it's a different beast. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but when all that's thrown at you and then you got to collect the forms and you're taking all that down, there's quite a bit to it. And it takes a little bit of time to kind of figure all that out. So,
I imagine, when I was thinking of your bio, I was thinking it seems like it's like you're getting your reps in, like you're getting the practice, like building up the different muscles that you need to perfect and hone this craft. And I was wondering, like, as you were doing this, was it 100% kind of on the job getting experience, or were you trying to like learn Photoshop through a class or online, or how did you go about building up all the components that you needed to be successful?
Yeah, it was a full-fledged, like I said, immersion.
Yeah.
Everything from what you were doing that day and that day's shoot, to assessing that day's shoot and trying to learn from it, to, spending the evenings going to bookstores or the library. The library was my best friend. I'd go there and I would just, anything on any subject that related to it, whether it was, you know, photography specifically, or design, or you know, any number of anything from everything from you know film, you know, the different languages of visual storytelling, and you know, web design and graphic design, and it was pulling all these different things together, and you know, to kind of create your own education for it.
And if, especially if someone's listening and they're liking this path that you forged, is there any particular books or resources specifically that stand out to you that you would recommend to them that would be a great resource for them in learning more about this?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I've used lynda.com quite a bit. There's so many different angles you can take to try to learn something there. And I know with a lot of like public libraries or like community college libraries, you get that for free with it. So, I mean, it's invaluable in that sense. If you got to pay for it, it can be a little bit expensive, anywhere from like 20, 25 bucks a month or something like that. But I know it's a really great resource, and there's endless topics there. But as far as a book goes, the book I always recommend is Stephen King's memoir on writing, which is a little bit, not quite a photography manual, but you know, if you go through that book and you just substitute writing with photography, it works about 95% of the time, and it's a fantastic resource for voice and for vision and for you know, I've always taken a little bit more of a storytelling approach to photography, and so that was a big help for me, was that book. And it's, you know, again, also anything that has to do with visual arts, I think can apply. So it's, I don't really recommend a photography book because a lot of them are manuals and technical. And I try to stay away from that. Because that's one of those things, again, you kind of learn by doing a lot with a lot of that. And you can learn by doing and then supplement that with, you know, the technical manuals and learning how about shutter speed and aperture and ISO and those things. But the, those other aspects, are the ones that, that really, are, I think they're harder to come by in resources.
I read Stephen King's On Writing as well, and one of the things that stands out to me most, and I think this applies to entrepreneurship as well as arts and different fields, but he described this loft he lived in, and they had this you know, board across the roof and this inch and a half thick nail, and he got his first rejection letter and slapped it up there, and he said by the time he was finally had just an article in a magazine published, that inch and a half or like 2.5 inch nail was full, just completely full of rejection letters. And I think it's just such a powerful example for anyone who forges their own way or takes a risk of just how much rejection you need to be willing to face. And I think I grew up, I love Stephen King, and I just grew up assuming he just wrote and was successful, and to realize like the amount of adversity and challenge and rejection he faced and overcame and persisted with is really inspiring. And I think it's such a good, valuable lesson for anyone to know that like, that's the attitude you have to go in with.
Yeah. It's, you know, I've conducted a photo a day project for the past almost 2 years now. And probably within the first 3 weeks or so, I actually started reading that book in conjunction when I started it. And so day like 15 or 16 or 17, somewhere along that lines, it's that quote. It says, "I replaced the nail with a spike and kept on writing." It was a picture of a crumbled up piece of paper. And, you know, so it's, yeah, again, it's the writing, the drawing, painting, you know, the business you're creating, you just replace whatever it is you do, you know, with, you know, what you do with, you know, with writing, and it makes sense. And it's, yeah, it's about forging and, you know, forging on ahead and, you know, despite all the people that say no, and, or, you know, say that you're doing it wrong or you're, that's what you're going to do. You know, it's not easy. A lot of people, you know, have, you know, circumstances around them that don't allow them to do that. But I think a lot of us have the right circumstances for stepping off and taking that risk. And if you're looking for the perfect scenario, you might not ever find it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And so you're at Carolina Sports. How do you make the transition to Playboy? Because it seems like in some ways it's like a different subject material, and then it's also going from like a relatively smaller company to, I'm imagining, one of the more difficult organizations to get through to.
Yeah, so that was, I stayed at Carolina Sports for about a year. I left in May, and by the time that next June rolled around, I had already developed the relationship at ESPN. So I would commute from South Carolina every so often up to back home to Chicago, and would shoot for the ESPN, the local radio station, some of their events and whatnot. And came home one time and found out that the Chicago Blackhawks were hiring a team photographer. And so I put in a word that I was interested in that through some of the people at ESPN, and whether that helped or not, I got an interview and flew home just for that. And it was in the process of doing that that I realized I needed to be back home in a bigger market. There would be more photographers in that bigger market, but there would also be more opportunity. And moved back home, went to that interview, didn't get it, but then tried to figure out what to do next. And so it was a process of, well, if I want to do something, you're supposed to go to school for it. And so I went to, I took a couple semesters worth of classes at a community college, to kind of just in hopes of developing a creative community for me to be a part of. I knew that was probably really extremely important because the communities I had previously, be it West Point, the Army, the ranks weren't filled with other, creative people who had kind of done or were doing what I was doing. And so it was a little bit of a challenge. And so I said, well, let me go see if I can create this other community. So it took two semesters worth of classes. And in the summer of, would have been 2010, I had decided to stop the community college route and took what would have been an internship, because I wasn't taking classes. I was just volunteering basically at a local newspaper, a suburban newspaper. And after about a week of doing that, I found a listing for a job opening at Playboy. And I had been shooting my high school's football team that previous fall. And I had come across a guy who actually graduated from the high school on the sideline of the state championship game. And he was senior photo editor at Playboy. Now we shared the commonality of both being photographers. We shared the commonality of both graduating from a Catholic high school. And within moment, after meeting him and then seeing that job opening, we then shared the distinction of both working at Playboy, which was kind of interesting. And it was a matter of, forging that relationship by being out and shooting. It was that act of being on the sideline of a football game and putting a project together that he became aware of me. And then the stars aligned, and then I was able to get my foot in the door there. So simultaneously, I was taking basically two internships. The job at Playboy was, I was making $8.25 an hour, working 3 days a week, in conjunction with volunteering at this suburban newspaper. So that's what my career looked like at that point in time. The work I was doing for ESPN was far and few between. Maybe once a month. Maybe at that time it was once every other month. It wasn't like that was a big payday there. It was just some consistent work that I had come across. And so, at one point in time, I was working for free on one hand and then making $8.25 an hour working at Playboy. And I came in as a photo editor. It was a really interesting interview there because they looked at my resume and they said, why are you applying for this? And I basically had to tell them, can you please ignore where I went to school and ignore my job history in the Army and don't tell me what I want. Because I want to get my foot in the door here. And yeah, you're right. The subject material was not, I wasn't in glamour photography. I had no interest in that sort of output, but getting the foot in the door at a company like that was a lot of interest to me. And it was through that process of being a photo editor, being on the other side of the camera, then that it opened my eyes to the idea that, you know, as a photographer, your creative process stops when you take a picture. For the most part, your process is over. And then for me at the photo editor side, or for the layout designers that were in our department, our process just began. And so there was this really interesting, you know, realization of how the creative process works, you know, from start to finish. And I was able to turn that 3 day a week into 4 days a week pretty quickly. And I got a promotion within the first few months of being there. And then I was working as an image technician, doing retouching. And then through the process of them downsizing, they let go of one of their layout designers and they asked me to fill in the void. And so again, right place, right time, but also the ability to take that chance and, yeah, I know how to do that, or I can learn it. And that was probably the biggest thing, was that they took a chance that he can learn how to do it. And I did. I ended up getting, like I said, I was there for about 2 years. And in those 2 years, I actually, while people were getting laid off and the art was getting taken off the walls and the office was getting boxed up, I managed to squeak out two promotions. So that was kind of interesting. And so I ended up walking away with not only a photo credit in a Playboy magazine, but also as a layout designer. And I don't know, it was that still kind of baffles me that happened that way. But it doesn't make any sense, because the next job I took was at my Catholic high school as a communications director. So, you know, like, you know, that's a lot of different 180s there that you pull, and it's, you know, it's that flexibility to kind of, you know, figure out what the common thread is through all that. And that can be tough, especially when you're changing jobs, and, you know, you've got these kind of full-time to part-time positions that are in the same world as being a photographer, but not fully being a photographer. And that's what Playboy was. I wasn't a photographer there, you know? And so that was an interesting dynamic. But I shot still. I was able to photograph, you know, some freelance jobs in conjunction with that being a part-time position.
And, you know, I love this theme of immersion, though, where you immerse yourself and you're at your high school and you're immersing yourself in this field, in this community. And because of that, it seems like these connections form where you're just living and breathing this. So you find these connections that lead from one opportunity to the next. What was day-to-day life like at Playboy? Like, what would be a typical day?
So I worked in the department called Special Editions, and we had, we were an autonomous unit, under the Playboy umbrella, and we weren't the main magazine. We were a subset magazine, and it was nothing but pictorials. So it was very much like a, you know, we completed, I think it was two, sometimes three magazines a month we would put together. They were 96 page magazines, and we did everything from start to finish. And so those magazines were filled. The pages were filled through a casting call. And so part of our department would go out to a new city once a month and conduct a casting call. The images would come back. That's what my initial job was to help our editors, our executive editors, help them kind of get all those images together so that they could process them and figure out who they would then give a call back to, and then set up, you know, a photo shoot with one of the freelance photographers. They would shoot those, they would do those shoots, then those images would come back, and then they would go to the layout designers and the image technicians. And so you would prepare those images, and then all the while you're there's a theme in mind for each issue. And so it was just from one month to the next, that process kind of repeated itself. And it was great, because, like I said, I was able to be a part of just about every step of that process, and never really picking up a camera. And, you know, But bringing all of the photographic knowledge that I had to the table of being a photo editor or a designer. And again, that's where, you know, and I talked before about how when I would go to the library and you would just gather things that looked interesting to you, not necessarily, I want to learn to be a photographer, go get a photography book. It's about, you know, learning visual language. And that's what that job also taught me was, you know, that the visual language is, you know, there's more of it beyond the actual task of taking a photo.
Was there, I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes, like you're going down this path initially of photography, you're always taking photos. When then this incredible opportunity at Playboy pops up and it's more on the editing side, was there a part of you that was like, oh, I want to stay behind the camera and therefore this might be not what I want? Or was there more excitement of like, yes, I get to build out another skill set and build up another muscle I haven't used? I'm just wondering if there's that like hesitation of doing something that wasn't 100% the direction you were originally going.
Yeah, at first my initial response was no, there was no concern at all. But then as I started to be there a little bit longer and my day-to-day was not photographing, that's when I decided that on my commute, my daily commute, so I would take a train into the city every day, and then I had a 2-mile walk to our offices. And so that's when I started doing street photography. And so it was this process of, again, supplementing the day-to-day work with basically a personal project, because I wasn't obligated to anybody in any of those images. It was all just for me. And so it became an outlet. And, you know, the really great thing about doing street photography, especially in a, you know, bustling city like Chicago, is that, I mean, it was never sit around in a place and photograph. It was always just on my walk. Mm-hmm. And so people were coming one way and I was going the other. And it was a matter of just kind of trying to capture something out of the chaos of that, of those movements every day. And it's not all that much different than shooting sports photography, because there's this thing that's happening and it's going to happen whether you're there or not. And it was about timing. It was about knowing what the camera's going to see. I mean, most of the street photography that I did was shooting from the hip. And so it wasn't with the camera up to my eye. And it was a really great lesson to learn, because I was able to shoot and learn what my camera was seeing without the obligation of what the output needed to look like. I could shoot for 2-3 weeks and not get a single image, but it didn't matter. But I was getting those reps in, like we do talk about before, getting those repetitions in. And it was about building muscle memory. And so then if I was ever in a situation shooting a game or an event or whatever, and I know that I need to get that shot, but I can't have my camera to my eye, I know what it's going to give me. And so you'll see where, you know, at a sporting event where a photographer sort of holding the camera up above their head and people are like, they don't even know what they're getting. But yeah, they do. They know what they're getting. They actually do know what they're getting. If they're good, they know what they're getting.
Do you have like mentors or role models in photography? I'm just kind of trying to construct this image of going from the Army and choosing a career that is just, it has so little in common, at least from my perspective, it seems like so little in common. And I'm just very impressed with this immersion that is in the library, on the walk to work, just constantly finding ways to hone this craft. And I'm curious if mentors or role models have in some way influenced you as well, or other ways you've kind of sought to forge this path through this unknown territory.
Yeah, it's that was one of the things that actually piqued my interest initially about photography, was that there was this concept of like the apprentice and the mentor. And when I first started getting into it, there were a lot of people that were kind of like, this is on its way out. A lot of the old guard was kind of, digital is going to take over and ruin it. And so I never really, I kind of got that like old cranky man feeling from a lot of people that I first originally kind of reached out to. And that wasn't the attitude I had. I had a very, very green, excited attitude. But for the most part, that hasn't really left. You know, I still kind of feel that way. Like, I still feel pretty good about I don't get worried about those aspects of it. But no, I find that more than anything, it's other art forms that I look to. more so than another person. You know, I'll look to, you know, like other visual medium, you know, film, or more, maybe more the language of film or the language of comic books, the language of graphic design. Like I look to those things, be it for inspiration or because I think maybe because the idea that I had that opportunity of being behind a camera and then working at a magazine where I wasn't behind a camera and it was more of like a directorial approach and, you know, understanding that big, wide realm of filmmaker is more of what I was more interested in rather than how to get a specific photograph. Mm-hmm. Pretty early on when I was making the decision to be a photographer, I had some, you know, some people that would ask like, oh, what's that mean then 10 years down the road? What's the big picture and everything? And I remember saying very specifically that there's a chance that I won't always be a photographer, but right now I feel like that's going to get me to the next thing. And so I've always had kind of an openness with it. I've kind of fought the idea of labeling myself as something specific just because people make a lot of preconceived notions about that. You tell them you're a photographer, they almost immediately think I take, you know, like family photographs, family portraits, or shoot weddings. And I have nothing against those things, but that's just not what I'm really all that interested in. And it becomes this process of like, once you get into that world, then you have to like defeat that stigma. That's, oh, that's not what I do. And it's like, oh, okay, well then what do you do? And then you can't really even can explain that. And so it can be difficult. And so I've always taken an open approach to what it is I'm going to be. And like I said, the photography led me to a magazine. So that's kind of why I was okay with it. But with that comes, you know, not a real like strong sense of, you know, of a specific mentor. You know, I reach out to people. I've built up a bit of a community of people I, you know, will reach out to if I'm, you know, trying to figure something out. And, you know, that's been a little bit tough. But it's, you know, it they're out there and you just have to find them and find the right people. And, you know, it's something I'm always still looking for. It's never too late to have one of those. And that's kind of how I look at it.
It's awesome. It's awesome. How did you go about starting Pestle Photography then? Is at like what point in the story do you decide to kind of create your own organization?
It was when I moved back to Chicago. It was when I decided to go back to school. That's when that materialized. And it just, you know, one of the first things I did, one of the books that I came across was some entrepreneur books. And the more and more I dug into the idea of being an entrepreneur, the less I wanted to be that. There's a, you know, the general sense is automate as much as you possibly can, scale. And I wasn't interested in that. And so that was a tough thing to kind of come to grips with, of trying to find your footing, because you're a business. But, you know, I think it's Stephen Pressfield wrote a book called the War of Art. So a little play on the art of war. And it's a pretty good breakdown of some of the hangups you can get yourself into by trying to do something creative and have it be a business, because you got to make money, but you also, there's a weird thing that happens when you try to create stuff, and when you're creating it and you're not being held obligated, there's no obligation. You create nice things and they're for yourself. And then suddenly someone pays you for it. And it's this weird collision that somehow stifles can stifle the process. And it's a weird thing, and I haven't figured it out totally, but you know, every day I hopefully get a little bit better at walking that line. And, but I knew early on that taking myself seriously with what I was doing, be it at a small level, be it at a part-time level, it was important to kind of have that distinction. If nothing else, to have separate bank accounts. And, you know, that was kind of the driving force with it. It wasn't, you know, that was really nothing more than that.
I think that's so interesting. I do think about creativity a lot, and I like what you said with a lot of entrepreneurship. There is kind of this pressure to scale and monetize, and it becomes a process, and it starts to distance you from the act of creation that I think attracts a lot of people initially. And I don't know if you've ever read, Elizabeth Gilbert has this book called Big Magic, and I just have found it's one of the few books I've read multiple times, but she talks about creativity, and like you had said about Stephen King, it's like, you know, mainly for writers, but you can kind of insert different art forms in there. And just all of these different ideas she has on how you feed creativity and how you can also kill creativity. And a lot of that comes when you're putting pressure on your inspiration to generate money rather than just, you know, doing what it sounds like you've tried to align your life with of enjoying the craft and creating for the sense of creating. And I think that's just a fascinating topic in general. I wanted to also ask about how you started with ESPN, and it sounds like that kind of preceded actually your work with Playboy, and it sounds like it started a little bit slower and then ramped up. But how did that initially take hold?
Yeah, it was my brother had been working as a part-time in their promotions department right out of college, and so he was working there. They had a golf outing, they needed a photographer. I had just started doing that, so they called me up, or he called me up and said, "Hey, can you come shoot this golf outing?" And that golf outing led to another job later in the fall, which led to something else, and then it started to. It was a good fit. For everybody, and it just kind of took hold. And like I said, I was able to, you know, photograph for them maybe once a month or so, maybe 10 times a year, over the course of a few years. And it's not as sexy as it sounds. It was a lot of like just live broadcasts. And I was able to get through that though. There were several situations that were kind of interesting. I was able to go photograph ESPN's the Mike and Mike, the morning show guys, as they threw out the first pitch at Wrigley. Was up in the booth with them when they sang the seventh inning stretch, and I did that for 2 or 3 years in a row. And that was kind of cool because when I was a kid growing up in Chicago being a Cubs fan, I remember I heard a story about Jim Abbott, and he had written on a piece of paper that one day he'll play in the major leagues, and he put it underneath his pillow every night. And I did that as a kid. I did that as like a 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old, whatever. And I had a one day play at Wrigley Field, and that was under my pillow. And you know, I didn't play as a baseball player, but I got to go play as a photographer. So, you know, that was you know, one of those moments where it was kind of like, you know, okay, cool. Like this is, you know, not everybody gets to go do that. Like the camera is starting to open up doors for me to places I have wanted to go. And so that was really cool. And you know, that the relationship with ESPN has stopped now at this point. I moved on from those jobs. And so it was a good, you know, it was a good thing to have back in those days when I was working either full-time or part-time at a photo-centric job, and that became a job I would go, you know, shoot every so often. And so it was again, even when I was working at, there was one day at Playboy where I worked at Playboy all day and then went to Wrigley Field and shot there, and I was like, awesome, like that's what my life is. I'm working every day at Playboy, and then I go, you know, go to the field, go shoot at Wrigley Field. That was pretty cool. So
Looking back, in what ways do you think that your military service has helped you in this direction? And in what ways have you had to kind of break habits from the military in order to be successful in this?
that's a question that comes up in different ways. Usually when I see somebody I haven't seen for a while and they've been following what I've been doing, and they're like, do you feel like you made right decisions? And I'm the way that, you know, like you kind of took the long way to get where you are, and I don't look at it that way. I mean, like, you know, it's a, you know, that you hear people say like it's the journey, you know, that matters, not the destination. And it's like it's all those experiences that I've gathered along the way that have helped inform me as a photographer. So, you know, when you Google a photographer or something like that, or you're searching for somebody and you're going to pick between one and the next, like everybody's got good cameras, You know, if you're, I would hope that most people that are presenting themselves as a professional are somewhat technically competent. So what's going to be the differentiating factor? It's you as a person. And so I get to bring all those past experiences with me to every shoot that I go on. And, you know, whether it comes up in small talk before the shoot, what my past was, or if it comes up after the fact, all of those things, you know, they inform it, they help me produce, you know, they help me forge those relationships. So I like, you know, just the people skills that you're able to develop in the Army, you know, the tenacity that you're able to develop, the work ethic, all of those things help differentiate you from being a flighty creative person. You know, so it's a, you know, there's a lot of good, you know, the biggest one is for me is that through 4 years at an academy and then 5 years in the Army, you develop a sense of confidence and you can't turn away from that path unless you're confident. And so I know that I made the right decisions because I don't know if I would be where I'm at today if I had gone to an art school, if I would have had the confidence to believe in myself to do it. So by going through those worlds and developing a sense of confidence of who I am, it allowed me to take that path out of the military that was a little weird or eyebrow raising. Conversely, the things that haven't, or the things I've had to break, that's also an interesting kind of concept with, you know, in terms of, it's funny because a lot of the things that would make me a competent creative person, such as the desire to be different or an urge to kind of, you know, buck a trend, those are the things that kind of would, you know, not necessarily provide the best, you know, OER bullet, you know. So that's an interesting aspect too, because I was that way as an officer, and it didn't always, the outward appearance of that didn't always play well, but I didn't necessarily believe in that part of me yet when I was an officer. And so it didn't play well, but I'm the same thing today as I was then, but now that same quality is a good thing today. But then it wasn't. So that's a weird thing to have to kind of learn about yourself, and that self-awareness of I need to be who I am and frame it properly, and then it's gonna be a positive quality. You know, also I think one thing that comes not so that's something that's kind of defeated a lot, especially in a military environment, is you know, the idea of being the loudest person in the room, and you know, the alpha male, the aggressive kind of mentality that's kind of required in that world. And, you know, kind of counter to that is when you say something, you're hoping that it connects with people. And sometimes the best way to connect with people is not by being the loudest in the room or being real aggressive. It's about being vulnerable, because people connect with vulnerability, but that's not really a great trait. It's not that it's not a great trait, but it's a misunderstood trait, probably as an officer, as someone who's supposed to be a leader, is this idea of vulnerability. And, you know, that's something that I've had to not necessarily defeat, but kind of just understand that's more of who I am, is, you know, putting myself out there in a way that's going to be vulnerable. You create something and put it out there, you're making yourself vulnerable. And that's not an easy transaction, no matter what it is. And, you know, sometimes you just have to embrace that. And I just can't imagine that conversation happening in, you know, a professional development in the Army. Be more vulnerable. You know, so that's a big difference between those worlds.
Man, I've asked this question now, I think this is like the 47th interview. I think that's by far the best answer I've gotten. I think it's just so true. I think that there's like so much of what you said that is so spot on and so good for any veteran or just person in general to listen to. And I personally believe like the biggest gift any person can offer the world is just to know who they are and find a way to just own it absolutely. And, you know, as you're saying that, it makes me realize like, yes, that's like, I can see the way in which so many traits that will make us all successful in our civilian life, which is, you know, being who we are, in some ways that can be suppressed in the military, where there's this sense of uniformity, and there's just reasons for that of being in extreme circumstances and having to lead in life or death situations. And that liberating feeling when you're outside of that environment to really just to dig deep and figure out who you are and just really be that person. So I appreciate the way you put that. One more question before I turn things over to you for just any catch-all or anything we missed. If you were able to go back to when you just got out of the Army, knowing what you do now, what's one piece of advice you would give to yourself at that age about the career that you've set out on?
I think it's about a realization of there's a really fine line between patience and panic. And as you decide to make a jump, no matter what the jump is or how far the jump is away from what you were doing, there's that tendency that we have to get right back to the level we were at. So like, for instance, when you leave the military, you're trying to find a job that's going to pay about the same or more than what you were making. It wasn't designed that way, but, you know, I had the opportunity to make a lot less. And that's a head scratcher for a lot of people. And then I took a job where I made $8.25 an hour. And that's a head scratcher to a lot of people. And, you know, I don't know if those things are sustainable over the long haul. But I'm still doing it almost a decade later. So, you know, I think I've been able to at least somewhat successfully kind of walk that line of being patient without panicking. But at the same time, too, whether it's a day-to-day thing, it teeters back and forth aggressively sometimes. And so I think I would try to find a way to tell myself about patience and panic. And, you know, it's sometimes, you know, you can tell somebody that the stove is hot, but they actually have to touch it in order to know that it is. And I think you need to allow yourself to be in some of those, if you have the ability. If you have the circumstances that allow you to do those things, is to take that chance and don't be so worried about success coming in the form of a dollar sign. And, you know, to go out there and make something for yourself. And that doesn't necessarily mean something creative. You could be building a company, you could, you know, building an idea. But to make it for yourself, not for somebody else, not for an amount of money, and see where that takes you. You know, I don't like that whole, oh, do what you love and the money will follow. You can do that, but that's kind of a recipe for a disaster. You've got to be a little bit more careful you got to make sure that the circumstances that you have, or you have, you know, security is built in place. But I didn't either. I wasn't saving up to start a photography company coming out. And so I was kind of forced into that world of dealing with that patience and that panic simultaneously. And I think it's a really hard thing to do, because we want to be real productive. We want to get right back into it. We want to take the, you know, go to get the MBA real quick. And get this real quick and get that and get on to the next thing. And, you know, I said it before about the journey being more important than the destination, is to just kind of, I think that's kind of what helps you balance the patience with the panic, is that the moment you're in is the moment you're in, and that's all you can really handle and take care of. And so having that mindfulness of the moment, and, you know, that moment, if approached properly, can lead to another moment down the road, or, you know, you start to piece together those things and you look back a couple of years down the road and go, hey, I've made some steps. You know, I might not be exactly where I want to be, but I've made some steps in the right direction.
That's awesome. Well, I know we're running short on time, and I always like to leave the last word and the last chunk just to turn it over to you. And I know we've covered a lot about your history and your career, but anything we didn't cover that you wanted to share, and just knowing you have this community of active duty and veterans listening, either about personal life or professional life, anything that we haven't covered that you'd want to say?
I don't know. I think we hit a lot of touch points along the way there. So there's nothing really standing out with it. Just, you know, take a chance, I think, is really the biggest takeaway is, you know, if there's something you like doing, go try it. You know, there's that another, you know, cliche is it's never too late. Like, just because you're reaching 30 or because you're reaching 35 or because you've already put, you know, time and effort into something doesn't mean you can't start over again. And, you know, I think there's a lot that can come from, you know, taking that chance and starting over. It's humbling, sure, you know, but, you know, you never know until you start exploring those things, what things you wanted to do when you were 17, 18, and they come back and they smack you in the face being like, oh, I guess I should have believed in that back then. Cause here it is again, right in front of me, you know, cause when I left high school, I wanted to be a graphic designer. I wanted to go play Division I football. And I chose playing football at West Point. And, you know, that got me back to, you know, something very close to being a graphic designer. And, you know, again, like I said, along the way, I found these little things as I dug in my past that showed I was on the right, or not necessarily that I was on the right path, but this was something that's been speaking to me my whole life. And so it's now just a matter of time of me now believing in it and going out there and trying to figure out how to make it happen.
Well, I have so much respect for the path that you've taken. I mean, in hearing your story, I hear so many echoes of my own decision to pursue entrepreneurship, but in comparison, I realize how many more people go down the entrepreneurship path than the path that you went down. And so I'm just replaying as you're talking all these conversations I had of people doubting my decisions and kind of second guessing me and just imagining how much more you've had to deal with on that. And so I have just a tremendous amount of respect for your willingness to kind of answer that call and that vocation, and because it does seem like what you're doing is a calling. It's not just a job. It is something that just clearly lights you up as a person. And it's so refreshing to hear your perspective on your journey and to see, like, you almost see this string of fate weaved throughout your story of, like, starting with graphic design and the things coming back full circle. And it seems like the universe has just supported you in this decision that you've made. And you've had the courage to continuously make decisions to go down that path when I'm sure it was far from clear at every step of the way. And so, you know, I appreciate your time in the interview, but I also appreciate the example and role model you are to other veterans of being able to take that leap. And whether that's after 20 years of service or after 5 years of service, knowing it's never too late to identify that passion and to go after it. And you can make that happen. And so thank you for both of those.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Surface, surface, surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, three important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.